Hi everyone, my name is Michael Frazis. Thanks for signing in. Today I thought I would go through a few interesting companies that have kind of had big moves over the last few weeks and the last couple of days. Also thought we knew a bit of work in crypto and in Web3, and I posted a couple of notes earlier in this week. So I thought we could discuss some of those as well. And I'll also go through our venture fund, give a bit more information on that. And of course, please write in any questions and I'll answer every single one that comes through. First, let me share my screen. So this is us. We invest in technology and the life sciences, focusing on companies with true customer love and explosive growth. It's been a pretty successful approach. We've identified quite a few things that have gone up 5 times or more, and it's a really helpful framework. And I'll actually go through some examples of companies that look like amazing tech companies but aren't today. First, I thought I'd talk about our venture fund. So we launched this last week, raised about $8 million in the first week. Basically, we were seeing a lot of opportunities through our broker networks and through our personal networks in the private space. Now, kind of a few different ways. We actually thought about, you know, doing a life sciences fund or kind of cutting the funds up in terms of strategy and opening up those. But I think the most natural way is actually to keep it in terms of structure. So have a listed fund that's designed for listed equities that can hold them long term, that can trade them, and can offer investors liquidity at basically any moment. Private's different. You know, private investments have some advantages. You know, you generally have much better information. You can meet management. You often can see management models. You have much better access to data. And you also can't trade out of them, which can be a blessing as well as a curse. You know, when you get something right, you really get the full outcome of it. Whereas, you know, we should have probably made more money than we did. We did that because, you know, in a listed fund, you can't really have one stock going to 70 or 80% of your fund. It's not really fair on people because, you know, you have an open fund where people are coming and going at all times. And it's not really what you're trying to do either. But in private land, you kind of have to do that because you can't just trade in and out of things. So it's a blessing and a curse. So we made a number of investments ourselves. They're pretty successful. We made a fair bit of money. So we thought we'd open that up to investors in the main fund. So if they want to be part of those private deals that we're doing, they're very welcome to come along for the ride. And so far, we've had a pretty good response from that, even though we only just opened it up. Now, I think the most important thing about the private fund is to note that it really works really well with a current fund. And the reason for that is it means that we get to see basically everything because we're active in the market. We kind of, if we see something good, we try and invest in it. You know, we do try and say yes rather than say no all the time. And it does give us access to the fastest growing companies very early in their life cycle. We get to meet management, we get to understand them. And because we're keeping this venture fund really small, we can get meaningful allocations. So Camplify is an example. We invested in this on our own balance sheet pre-IPO. Remember when IPO came, we knew the story, we'd met management, we understood, we were optimistic, wanted to hold it long-term, got a much better allocation than we would have otherwise. That all went to the main fund. So allocations will always go to the main fund, IPO allocations and capital raises. And we were able to buy the stock after as well. You know, we were confident and had the data and the information, the access to make a very quick call. And it kind of traded, weirdly, it traded kind of like soggily for the first, you know, few months, and then it's taken off. You know, it's now, we can add it to our list of companies that have gone up 3 times or more. Camplify is really interesting because it actually grew over a period where their main market, Australia, was shut. And, you know, it's a great business model. You know, RVs just sit there. There's clearly a need for people to kind of make use of those assets and rent them out. Similarly, when if you want to go on one of these holidays, renting one makes a lot of sense financially. And it's also something that has its own little nuances as a business. So it's something you kind of want a specialist doing that. So Camplify has been pretty successful. And you can see the value of their model by the fact that their take rate is actually higher than, say, Airbnb's 24%. So we're really excited because it's very hard to find fast-growing companies that are leveraged to a recovery, that will do well in recovery. And this is one of those. And most importantly, it's something that our early access enabled us to invest in. Getting early access in the pre-IPO meant that the fund benefited and the fund actually made a lot more than we would have privately. So that's kind of what we want to do with the venture fund. We want to be active, positive, constructive contributors to companies in that early stage of growth, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years out from IPO. And then through our main fund, you know, support the IPO and then hold them long-term after that as well. Like that's kind of what we're trying to do. This was another one. So this the chart on the right shows Mawson. This is a crypto miner. We actually got in, I think, around $2 privately. And then this company listed it, did a cap raise at $8. So at $8, we were able to put all that money in the, we were able to allocate quite, we got quite a serious allocation in the main fund. And this chart is a day late. So it's actually trading at about $15 now. So it just shy of doubling up in a very short period of time. And again, it was the fact that we had access to the company privately and were supporting them along the way that enabled us to get the allocation and also enabled us to know what was going on. You know, if you just saw this, you know, we just sit here in a desk, you, all day people, brokers will be sending you, look, this company's raising capital today. You don't even have enough time to do the work. You really need these companies have been following for a long time, that you've kind of been supporting for a long time. When they do a cap raise, that's when you can be really supportive. And it's been a pretty good investment for us as well. So this shows the latest little price lift. And the cap raise in the main fund was done at $8. One of the more interesting companies lately was Zillow. So we don't own Zillow, but we do own Opendoor. So we'll discuss that. Zillow, the story of Zillow, and I wonder if I've got a longer term chart somewhere. So Zillow got in a lot of trouble in 2018. The stock basically halved. It was a fund in Australia that had, you know, three main investments, all of which halved. I think Zillow was about half of it. And the company's under a lot of pressure. The problem with Zillow is, Zillow's like a real estate platform, kind of like realestate.com.au. But in Australia, realestate.com.au, you advertise to the entire market. So if you want to sell a house, you'll pay domain, realestate.com.au. You pay all these people just to list your product and promote it. And that's because you want as many buyers as possible to see it. Now, Zillow doesn't work like that. And Zillow, that listing is free. And there's multiple sites that will do it. And Zillow actually, part of their growth came from buying the number two. You know, part of their growth came from acquisition, not the good organic stuff that we like. And so Zillow's business model is actually through the agents. In the US, you have sellers and buyers agents. And so Zillow gets a share of their revenue, and the agents use Zillow to market themselves. So if you look at a house, you can then advertise yourself as an agent. So on one hand, you've got, in Australia, you've got realestate.com.au, which is advertising to everybody. In the US, you've got a model that's effectively advertising to a tiny group of agents. And it's good business. It's the profitable, high margin. But saturated, you know, there's no international plans. They bought the number two and the top line kind of stopped growing. And you've got a problem. If you're losing a ton of money, and we're super comfortable, the right company that's investing heavily and growing super fast, like that is our sweet spot. Like we know how to analyze these. We've analyzed them again and again. This is an example of a company that is at that, looks like a tech company, but doesn't have that explosive growth. And he's still losing money. So the return on investment is really low. So what happened around 2018, there was a CEO there who came and was paraded around Australia. I always had a thing against him because in his prior startup, and I don't know the full details, but he did give an interview about it. In his prior startup, he sold his business and he sold it in such a way that all the employee equity got wiped out. And so in venture capital, often when VC funds put money into companies, they'll give themselves preference shares. So if there's a round and an equity sits above that. So let's say there's a down round and the value cuts in, not at the preference share, not the equity somewhere below, you know, cuts in the preference shares, equity holders get wiped out. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think if your employees are sitting in the equity piece, you have to look after them. Like it should be kind of employees first, debt holders, protected equity people, then equity. I think if you do a deal that wipes out the employees, and remember, management is always fine because management has to get paid to do the deal. Whenever these companies are restructured, there's always something carved out for management. Management is fine. But if you do construct a deal such that you get paid and your employees lose everything, I think that's like a really poor character and really poor form. And this was a Zillow CEO that everyone was paraded around Australia like God's gift. But anyway, the stock basically halved in 2018. And then they came up with this idea that they'd copy Opendoor's instant buying model. And that was a huge shift. Now, what that did is it meant they could say that a huge TAM. It's like we have an enormous TAM. You know, we got the entire US real estate market and it caused a huge uplift in growth. I wonder what else I've got. A huge uplift in growth. Obviously, you're a fund manager and a stock does this. I mean, the main fund that has a huge position there would have cashed out possibly, you know, a small fortune in that rise. And Zillow was never making money on these things. They're losing money, but they're promising the world. And that caused that rip. And it wouldn't have just been the funds, it was also management. So if you look in the middle here, you've got share-based comp since, say, 2018. And I know it's kind of mid-2018, but anyway, let's just take 2018. That's $550 million of share-based comp that was paid out. And some of that would be options. So some, the dilutive effect of that would actually be higher. So in 3 years, you basically came, you're under a huge amount of pressure, stock's down 50%. You then go, okay, we're going to go in this new business, share price rockets. 3 years later, you've paid out over $500 million to the management team. The funds that wrote it on the way up would have probably crystallized their fees at some point along that. But I guess we probably shouldn't talk too much since if we did something similar, it would be the same. So I can't criticize them too much for that, but I will criticize them for then winding up the business. And so that was the problem. So all that like hype and pump and all those huge payouts that were crystallized in a business that now doesn't exist. So now everybody needs to go back and remove whatever value they subscribed, future value they subscribed to this business. And now we have about a 5%, I think it's about a 5% position in Opendoor. So we need to discuss like why we're optimistic on Opendoor when Zillow themselves have come out of the market. There's a couple of things. So this is what the current Zillow CEO, Rich Barton, said. So they said they wanted to be a market maker, not a market risk taker. Now, the problem was there's like a 3 to 6 month gap between when you buy and sell. So you are taking risk. You're not making markets. Making markets is slightly different. They said here that their unit was swinging from making 5.7, say 6% to minus 5 to 7%. So huge swing in profit in like kind of the most core basic level of profit. And they've now said that scale would require too much equity capital, too much volatility in earnings and balance sheet and low return on equity. The other interesting point he said is they've only been able to convert 10% of the sellers who asked for a Zillow offer. So 90% of the people said no. So what almost certainly was happening to some degree is that people were getting their Zillow offer, and if they didn't like it, they weren't taking it. If Zillow was overpaying them for the house, they know the house, they live in it. If Zillow was paying more than it was worth, they know the neighborhood better as well, then they were hitting the bid. So Zillow was getting lifted on all the houses that were poor value, the ones that Zillow would have been getting a good deal, the owners knew and wouldn't have done it. But it kind of gets a bit worse than that. Actually, let's talk a bit more about Opendoor. So the other thing, a huge difference between Zillow and Opendoor is that Zillow is like a high margin, if not growing, it's not growing very fast, but high margin, you know, internet platform. It's very different to kind of buying and selling houses where it's like a low cost, much kind of less pleasant business. You know, it's much less fun being in these kinds of things. And they're completely different cultures. So you think about Zestimates. Zillow's cool thing was that you type in your house and you get an estimate of the price. People love tracking that stuff. Amazing for traffic. So really good for getting traffic to a website and getting people like engaged and having fun and that's exactly what, you know, their business, original business was. What it turns out it wasn't very good at was predicting actual prices and then transacting on those prices. Now, Opendoor doesn't have a lifeboat. They can't turn around and say, actually, we can't do this anymore. They've also been doing it for much, much longer. So they used to charge 12% for these instant offices. They've already cut that down to 5, but that 5 is fluid. If they need to, they'll raise it. All of their margins had positive earnings, which compare that to Zillow's comments, where sometimes they're making 5%, sometimes they're losing 5% or 6 or 7 in an unpredictable fashion. The other thing is, look, you can see in the other comments is that their conversion is about 50%. So Zillow was converting 10%, Opendoor's converting 50%. So they're clearly getting it right on the customer side as well as the sale. Now, these aren't my charts. These are from, I've put a credit there, www.mikedp.com. So have a look if you want to see the original source. But they're pretty interesting. So you can see here in Q3, Zillow has done a huge jump in buying. Now look at this top right. I never know if anyone can see the mouse, but I'm pointing to like the chart on the right, iBuyer acquisitions in Phoenix. You can see that Opendoor actually pulled back. It was a soft, weak market. Opendoor pulled back. Zillow charged on. You can see that in this chart as well. You can see the Opendoor cut back hard on their iBuyer acquisitions. Zillow actually increased. Now, this is the more interesting part. You can see here the median purchase price in Phoenix, so this market that slowed down, Opendoor dropped their prices while Zillow was raising them. You can see this is quite significant. So in August, they raised the average price from 440 to median price from 440 to 480, an extra 40,000. It's about 10%. These are low margin businesses. Opendoor was pulling back. So something, Opendoor was seeing something in the algorithms to pull back both the buying and the prices at which they're buying, but Zillow did not. So my guess is Zillow bought all these houses and all of a sudden realized they weren't able to sell them. Another interesting one was, this also shows some other data, again from the same site. This isn't my data, this is somebody else's. So buy to list in Phoenix, Opendoor was making 1%. So they just managed to scrape through with a profit in a terrible market. Zillow was losing 6%. In Atlanta, which apparently by the seams of things was going better, Opendoor was making 6.5%. Zillow was making 1%. And if you convert into dollars, you know, Opendoor was at least making $4,000 purchase. Zillow was losing $29,000. So you can see in the data the problems, and you can see that once Zillow started seeing those losses on increasingly large amounts, their hands were tied. This is the problem with Zillow. This is why Zillow had to do this. They had to find some exciting new business they could then promise the world to. The reason for that was their core business was under decline, and it has been declining. It has been weak. It's been kind of ex-growth for quite some time. The average monthly unique visitors declined by 4%, and the visits declined by 4% as well. So you now got a shrinking business, it's losing money, doesn't have their big VC thing. It'd be very hard for them now to pivot and come up with some other new idea, though I'm sure that ultimately, strategically, they're going to have to find something. But this is a mess. This is not what it's about. This is not good tech investing. This is not a good tech company. It's not like it's worth nothing, but it has been pretty poorly managed, I'd say, and it's not really investable. And the reason I'd say it's poorly managed is there's these huge share-based comp payouts, 550 mil, when you're ex-growth. I think management's job in these roles is to find growth opportunities that, you know, that at least grows, at least have positive gross margins, and they haven't. But 550 million is a lot. That's a lot of money for a small group of people. It's funny, isn't it? Everyone thinks like, in Australia, people think in finance. In the US, you think tech. But corporate America gets paid a fortune, you know, at least probably an order of magnitude, if not two orders of magnitude, more than in Australia. Like a mid-tier company in Australia pulling out 550 mil of executive comp in like 3 years is pretty intense. Anyway, so somebody asked about Tesla. Look, Tesla was huge. We had a small position. I think it was about 2.5%, which obviously is now worth, you know, 4%. Revenue increased 57%. Everything's just going in the right direction. That 26 gross margin, we talk about customer love. They are doing what Apple is doing. Tesla was always the Apple. They were always the one that was, everybody was competing, and then they were charging more and they were just better and doing everything in-house and look at what happened next. We've shown this chart a lot. So if you look at this one in the middle, if you've watched any of our content, you'll have seen these red bars. Well, we've got another new red bar, 600,000 cars in the first 3 quarters. So not quite a million, but I'm sure they'll crack a million soon. So even from when I was showing this chart, there was like 22,000, 50,000, 300,000, 500,000. Could double again in less than 2 years. A downside of this is, and let me just see if I've got the chart. No, I haven't got the chart. Give me a bit of a forewarning of what we're going to discuss. So Tesla's trading, when Tesla was cheap, which was like 3 years ago, it went sideways for 4 or 5 years. And full credit to Cathie Wood and all the people that held out, because to not make money for so long is difficult in this business. I'm trading about 3x sales and 15 to 20 times EBITDA. So pretty cheap by any standards. This is that long, flat period. They've since rocketed up to kind of over 20x sales. And that's kind of where they peaked, you know, earlier in the year, 20x sales. They're now kind of 50% or significantly bigger. But we're back at those kind of like valuation highs. And it's pretty hard. You know, you make your money buying stuff like this, 3 to 10x sales, certainly 3 to 5x sales. You don't really make your money buying these things at 20-25x sales. So much as I love Tesla, I wouldn't recommend like piling in here if you're considering it. Okay, on to crypto. So I sent out a couple letters. The point I wanted to make is, I think the slides are at the back. The point I wanted to make was, there's actually like a proper revolution going on. So one of the criticisms was there's been no use for crypto. That's not exactly true. So if you think about like, human history, artists have generally been like very poorly paid and underappreciated, always. Maybe a very tiny amount of people are fashionable in their own time. And then even then you'd have to be born in certain periods where the fashionable artists were making money and getting good commissions. Generally, they didn't. Now, for the first time, artists are making small fortunes. So Beeple made one of these every day. You can follow him on Instagram. They're kind of like, there's something to this art. You know, it definitely has an emotional impact. You feel kind of a bit weird and funny looking at it. But he sold 5,000 daily artworks for $69 million earlier in the year. And that was impressive. That was like, okay, this is like clearly something going on. And one of the reasons it's happening is because there's $2.5 trillion of crypto value sitting on the balance sheets of the strangest people on the planet. These are odd people that bought Bitcoin and held it for 10 years. You know, but now they have all this wealth. And it's only natural, as people do, to spend some of it on art. And obviously with NFTs, where you can make a digital representation of ownership, you can then code things into that you could not do before. So you couldn't make it so that an artist got 10% of all future sales, but you can now. And if you like an artist and you want to kind of, you know, effectively bet on their future, you can do that as well in a way that you couldn't really do other than to buy their artwork. And so think about how this has revolutionized the lives of artists. They can sell their work, then get ongoing streams if and when they're successful. And this all happens much more naturally. Like, you don't have to go to some random gallery. Like in Sydney, if you wanted to buy art, you'd probably go, there's probably a handful of places you could go, look at whatever that happened to be there and select that. Or go to a dealer who would then have their own extremely like 0.0001% of the good art that you might like. You can now do this, you know, on a global scale, and artists can attract a global market. Similar thing in music. So people don't think about something like Spotify, to a lesser extent YouTube. Those companies made tens of billions of dollars out of artists that get paid nothing. So the stats were something like 7 or 8 million artists, of which, was it 14 or 40? Anyway, tens of thousands of them were making more than 50 grand a year. So the vast majority of people on Spotify do not make 50 grand a year. Spotify founders and shareholders and so on made a bundle. Actually, not the shareholders. The recent shareholders have had a harder time, but the early VC investments. And then remember, Spotify was a private company. So unless you're a venture capitalist in the right part of the world or one of the wealthiest people on the planet, you didn't have access to it. All that value was captured by a very tiny group of founders and a very tiny group of early backers. Now, in crypto world, it's not the same. You know, an artist sold an NFT for, I think he calculated, like millions of hours of Spotify streaming time, one NFT. You know, people want to support the artists and pay the artists, the musicians. We want to do it. There's just no real way to, this hasn't existed before. This whole mechanism hasn't existed before. It's very real. It's changing the lives of art, music, a bunch of other places that we'll write about as well. And this is another example. So photography. This photo apparently is reprinted everywhere. The photographer, Kath, gets absolutely no monetary value for it. She sold one NFT for a small fortune, or several hundred thousand, and then she made it open for everybody. And I think this is what's going to end up happening. You know, everything's kind of free. You can download the JPEG, but if you want to say you have ownership, you want to support the artist, you want to grow with their growth in popularity, you can do that now. And this is much better than, say, Adobe, Web2 company, taking everybody's images and then charging people like me, when we need to use them, $50 a month or $60 a month, and then giving basically none of that to the artists. Like, that is the old world being like of about a year ago. The new world is these people are getting real money in real time on their terms. The people paying it are happy. Like, this is what we always wanted to do. I don't think anybody kind of wakes up and wants to make Adobe shareholders richer. Very happy to contribute like meaningful amounts of money to favored artists, musicians, photographers. This is all real. This is not changing. It's not going away. The other one is gaming. So cool thing about crypto is you can actually see everything in real time. So you can see every dollar of revenue that goes through, say, Ethereum protocol. So this is just the last 30 days. So there's $1 billion of fees. If you know anything about Ethereum, you'll know everybody hates gas fees. Well, this is gas fees. $1 billion has gone out of the wallets of Ethereum holders and users. This will change, and I'll tell you like how it will change after. But what I wanted to draw your attention to is Axie Infinity, the game here. So $190 million of revenue in the last 30 days. So well over, $2 billion run rate at the moment. And what it is you basically play these kinds of games. You get these characters. You trade them. It's kind of like Pokemon. They have different characteristics. You can breed them. You can fight them. You can build you can get an entry-level character, build it up to something valuable and sell it. And all kinds of things. The difference is the most interesting thing is anybody can participate. Anybody can capture that value. So one thing I like to think about, all this Web3 stuff, it's all behavior that we're doing now that just wasn't able to be implemented anyway. So people used to do this. People used to play World of Warcraft and the game on the right's RuneScape. Used to play these games, build up big characters, and sell them to the West. The problem was there were random companies that squashed this behavior. They made it illegal. Because it was illegal, it moved into the shadows, moved into the black market. If you tried to buy a character, there's a good chance you'd be ripped off and you'd be sending money to somebody that would and not get anything back. And if you're trying to do this, if you're a really poor person in I don't know, Nigeria or something, just trying to make a buck out of building up these characters, at any time the game could delete your character and just lock you out. There's no transparency. It's controlled arbitrarily by a small group of people. Now, interesting, if you think about the revenue opportunity here, this is so much more fun, so much more natural. Playing for actual cryptocurrency, you can then like transfer in and out at will, is so much better. But all the main game companies like Blizzard, Activision have all said they're not going to do anything, not going to have anything to do with this stuff. And that's because they see the threat. They could embrace the threat or they could try and oppose it. And they've taken it upon themselves to oppose it. But who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. Like, this stuff is happening whether or not you want it to or not. Like, you can hate on, it's like across the crypto space. You can kind of wish that Bitcoin wasn't worth $2.5 trillion, or the crypto space wasn't worth $2.5 trillion, but it just is. And it's happening whether kind of people want it to or not. So better to be on the right side, I think. You can also stake Axie and you get about 126% a year, not including reinvestments. So again, if you like Axie, you don't even need to play it. You can just back the token, and as the use of the game increases, the value of the token will increase as well. Or you could get it wrong and back the wrong game, but in either case, at least there's capital there to develop it. So it's a really powerful way for people to participate in these things. There's another one coming, which is effectively like, it's Sandbox. And what I've got here is Minecraft. And people put together brick by brick copies of like Minas Tirith and like random cities in Westeros, Game of Thrones, made immensely elaborate machines that actually worked. In Minecraft, people spent years, I don't even know what the right kind of word is, but huge amounts of time creating extremely elaborate structures, but they didn't own them. They're kind of owned by the game. There's no broader influence of that. In crypto land, you can build these kinds of things, and they're NFTs. You can sell them, you know, and you can transact with them, and anybody with a crypto wallet can immediately transact and either buy or sell or trade or contribute to any project. Again, it's like Minecraft, but on steroids, and, you know, infinitely better in the way that people can participate and play the game. And I think there was a few charts somewhere on that, but they have vanished. Could ask a bit about Facebook's metaverse, so I thought I'd just address that. I think this is pretty lame. Nobody wants to go into a meeting like this. If we do, we don't really want weird characters and VR goggles. And I just don't think Facebook's the right person to do it, the right company to do it. You know, they're kind of shown again and again what matters most to them, and that's driving eyeballs and driving advertising revenue. And there's a broader thing, you know, this concept of advertising revenue, that's basically how the internet is funded at the moment, whether you're talking about Zillow, Facebook, Google, and of course, all kinds of problems, because to get advertising dollars, you need more people engaged. People get engaged when they're angry and they're kind of like wound up. You know, either wound up in any kind of way. But it's not healthy. It's like, we shouldn't be wound up. And I'd say, like, in the last few years, like, Facebook used to be delightful, like an absolute delight. Like, you'd see photos from people that you'd never see, you hadn't seen in years. You could connect with people in the past, like, you'd have lost their number. Like, there was just no way for you to connect with them. It was an absolute delight and a global treasure. And then over the last few years, it's a nightmare. It's a horror show. I got family, like, multiple family members have been like radicalized by it. It causes political arguments. And I'm just talking about my own family. Globally, it's been even worse. You know, people are using it to kind of organize genocides, to like share all kinds of outrageous content. Again, you know, the outrageous stuff is what's going to spread. I think like Facebook washes their hands. Like, this isn't us. You know, we're just platform. You know, we're neutral. This is human nature, and we'll do our best in certain ways, in certain parts, stamp it out. But that's frankly bullshit, because Facebook gets money from it. So if they were just doing some neutral platform, that's fine. But if you're making money because a post that causes serious damage is spread virally, you know, you are responsible, because you're taking the dollars and putting them in your back pocket. Like, I really think they're linked. And I think this will flop. Facebook's metaverse will almost certainly flop, because the people who are excited about metaverse, I mean, metaverse is ultimately a gaming thing at the moment anyway. It's got to be exciting and fun. And Facebook is not that. One more thing on gaming quickly. Just to give an example of what could happen. So this is a game called Star Atlas. So the idea here is you can buy these ships, the NFTs, they cost tens of thousands of dollars. If the game takes off, you can be damn certain they'll be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions. And basically you can farm, you can basically explore planets, find asteroids, mine them, and go into wild regions and battle. And obviously if you lose a ship, you lose a ship. And if you take somebody else's ship, as a pirate, you take somebody else's ship. And so imagine how much, these games are heaps of fun. These like RuneScape, World of Warcraft, all similar concepts, all the most like addictive, engaging games on the planet. But it was all kind of just done for fun. Imagine what it's like when you can mine cryptocurrency and then stake that. And when you go into battle, it's a ship that you've been building up for a few years that's actually worth something. The stakes are just so much higher. It's just like everything. It's nascent behavior. This behavior already existed. Crypto world, it is far more exciting. I'm looking forward to see if this game plays out. What do we have next? We asked about Pinduoduo. So we wrote a bunch of stuff around July, so 3 months ago, about China. Broadly, that was pretty close to the lows. It was like after this big dip. And, you know, Alibaba's done pretty well since then. We've broadly shifted into Coupang, actually. So we now think that Coupang in South Korea is a much better play. You can see 98% growth versus 91%. Pretty similar growth, 2x sales versus, you know, 8x sales. I know there's various different accounting, the way people do GMV is slightly different. It's not apples to apples. But also SoftBank is selling, so we know why it's going down. Apparently they apparently they took a margin loan out on their entire position, which is classic SoftBank behavior. But when that selling pressure goes, I have no doubt they'll regret those sales. And this is much more exciting. Futu and Tiger, confusing. So these are the ones that actually cost us money lately. So if you think about it, we'll kind of, I guess when we wrote those articles on China, China bottomed, but that was kind of around here. And then Futu and Tiger legged it down. The reason for that is they're kind of in a bit of a, they're in a complex situation. So the way it works in China, there's very strict capital controls. You can't deposit, you need to exchange currency through official channels. But if you're offshore, there's nothing to stop you from buying offshore assets with offshore dollars. And that's kind of the situation Futu is in. So they're taking money from they're not, you can't deposit Chinese currency with them and then buy US stocks, but you could take US dollar money that you had as a Chinese citizen and buy their stocks. Now, these things were kind of like, they're licensed in parts of the world, but not China. There seemed to be, there was a movement to say, actually, we need more of this, like more Chinese investing offshore, less Chinese investing in real estate, for all the kind of distortions that was creating, because it was basically the only real, one of the very few assets that people can invest in the country. At the moment, it's these are complicated positions. We've actually, we don't do it often, but, you know, we've converted our Futu position largely to options. I'd say broadly, you know, the risks, there are always risks there. This is a company that the rewards there too. It went from 800,000 users to 1 million users in 3 months. It was doing something right. Of the whole Robin Hood craze, all that kind of stuff, of all of those companies, Futu, to me, looked by far the best. But there was a risk, as there is in any country, that regulations change. And at the moment, there's like noises. Nothing's changed for them yet, but there's noises that it might. It's very hard to understand what's going to happen. So we've converted it to an option position. And broadly, I'd say this is just one of those ones that, yeah, I guess we lost money on it. So certainly can't win every game, every match, every season in financial markets. And that's an example of that. There's a couple other things I want to share. So let's share some of these charts. So Solana is like the favorite one. So Ethereum, I showed you that $1 billion of 30-day transaction volume played to validators. Solana is basically instant. If you use Solana, you're like, wow, this is what cryptocurrency should have been. Ultra fast, fast enough to use in game as the core of gaming. That Star War kind of game that I was talking about is built on Solana. So everything that happens there is verified by the blockchain. But yeah, wow, this has gone up a lot. I don't want to like try and convince anyone to buy this after that kind of move, but it was the one that I always liked the most. Ethereum's also been very strong. There's two companies I thought I'd mention. So everyone knows Coinbase. Galaxy is kind of like, I think, pretty interesting. They're setting themselves up as the investment bank of the crypto world, and particularly in crypto where it's so difficult. It's technically difficult, extremely risky for any institution. There's hacks. There's no, if you lose a password, there's no password recovery. It really is wild, but there's obviously huge potential as well. So I think the number one players in all the various categories will do extremely well. So Coinbase, printing cash, it's about a 5% position for us. Galaxy is interesting because they've got a venture capital, prime broking, principal investments. They're doing all that kind of extremely profitable investment banking activity, only in a much more profitable world. Kind of like what I imagine investment banking was like 50 years ago. You can see pretty extensive growth. So in Q3, they only grew by 12%, but that was when cryptocurrencies actually went down. You can see the trading volumes went up 90% in 3 months. And it's just ripped in the last few weeks, but very recently, you know, this was like $7, $8 billion and they made it about $1 billion. So these are some of the cheapest, fastest growing companies around. And if you believe in the crypto space, you know, these people will do very well with pretty substantial volatility, but that's kind of the game we play. We invest in volatile assets with the highest potential long-term returns. Voyager Digital is another one. This is kind of the fastest growing listed exchange. You can see these crazy numbers here. But again, I'll draw attention to this. Very profitable and 6x sales. So this whole space really reminds me of software 5 years ago, where everyone was like, oh my God, I can't believe these stocks have gone up so much. But it was the beginning, not the end. And they're all trading at very high margin, trading at mid-single digit EV sales and making money, obviously, before investments. So they're a couple of companies that I think are actually quite interesting. I'm going to check into the questions. So love to hear your thoughts on Futu. Gave that, we have options on it. I just want to see what happens. The thing with Futu, the other thing I didn't mention is they have significant of say, the 200,000 new customers they got in the last quarter, most of them were offshore, so places like Singapore. And China has done cryptocurrency bans. In general, what they did was they froze the Chinese accounts, so you couldn't have new accounts in China. But they did let those businesses keep their offshore businesses. And that kind of gives something of a flaw to Futu and Tiger having fallen so much. Tesla valuation upside. Look, Tesla, look, as I mentioned, multiples gone up to the 20s. EV sales, it's 26% gross margin. I guess it's possible you could long-term have something that was like 10 times that. So 2.5 to 5 times sales. That'd be like the absolute top end of the long-term multiples. There, my view is there will be significant multiple compression, but I promise you there's going to be enormous growth as well. So it's one of those trade-offs. Software and solar growth, yes. What sort of IRR is coming through your base case models? We don't like do one IRR, we'll do like a map of them. And how would I describe it? Let's say you model something that's going to triple, but then you sell it every time something doubles. That means you'll never get anything that goes up 3 times. So probably something like Tesla is it went sideways for a long time, then moved very fast. Now you could sell it now when you think it's overvalued, but if you actually want to be there for 5 to 10 years, you cannot systematically sell things that rip like that. So even though we think in the short term, the upside is probably pretty limited from here, the long-term game is still crystal clear. I think there's going to be a ton more Teslas driving around, that's for sure. Open algos making them better decisions at the right time. Agree with that. Thoughts on great resignation and how work is changing? Yeah, look, I think I don't think I have any particular insight on that. I would say, you know, that having 1, 2, 3 days from home seems like the way it's going to go. Zoom's kind of interesting. I wonder if Teams takes down Zoom or if there's enough people that just don't want to work with Microsoft. You know, I think it's for the better. I think the creator economy is the crypto. You just couldn't. If you go back and think of all the different crazes, crypto, they make so much more sense with crypto. So I'll give you one, crowdfunding. So crowdfunding was huge and really cool, whether it's crowdfunding for science, for art, for things like Patreon, for like new projects, for new businesses like Kickstarter. But it just didn't work nearly as well as crowdfunding in crypto, where you have firstly a huge pool of liquid assets that anybody can invest in, and it's all just innately built, so it's just designed for that kind of thing. There's so many little business models like that traditional VCs backed and made a bit of money in that will be 10, 20, 100 times larger and better in crypto. And creating anything to do with creating is similar, because you can now sell your stuff in a market in a trusted way. Like, yeah, there are marketplaces for art, but who would spend more than a few $100 on something that like that? It's not secure, it's not backed, it's going to change. And any public companies we're following in the space, looking at Zoom, but in general, you know, every time we stray from a portfolio of winners, we tend to lose money. So Zoom is one with a question mark. it's winning now, but it's not sure what's going to go next. I can definitely form a view. I have a pretty strong view, actually. But I don't really want to invest on that view unless we can see some data and get some real insight into the fact that we're getting it right. Thoughts on Toast? I haven't actually done enough work on that to say something. Could you talk about why you like Sand over Manor? I'm unsure which one of these will be better. Sandbox hasn't actually launched yet. Neither has that Star Atlas game. So all that value that's been created, or all that like transactable value, is for games that don't even really exist yet. Any more info about opening fund for retail? Well, now we've launched our venture fund. The team is now working on the retail fund. I think it'll be about 3 months. We will do our best to do it as fast as we can, I promise. Have you looked into Paradigm Pharma? Yes, we've looked at it. I find repurposed drugs difficult. Smart people have decided not to develop them. Generally, the IP is pretty tenuous as well. The risk with all these things, and I know because I got burnt once, so it's a risk that manifested. Actually, I got pretty lucky. I sold out a profit and then like just somebody talked me out of it based on IP, based on exactly what I'm telling you now. And within a week, that thing was down like 90%. What happens is you can repurpose these drugs and you have the patents, you have the IP, but nobody's going to test that IP until you prove it works. If you don't prove it works, then who cares? All the investors lose their money. If you prove it works, that's when the IP gets tested in the courts. So you could have something, and again, I haven't looked at Paradigm in a while. I'm commenting generally, not on Paradigm. I'm commenting generally on the idea of repurposing drugs. You can get all the patents, you can get it approved by FDA, go through the entire approval process, and then the lawsuits start. And that's just something to be aware of. The IP gets tested after it's successful. So even if there's successful trials, that's like the first part of capturing a lot of value. In a weird way, it kind of makes sense. I mean, these are drugs that exist. They've been around for a long time. They're off patent. It's hard. It's difficult. The difficult situations. Curious to see how you're seeing Chegg. So Chegg grew at like, I can't remember what it was, 12% year on year. Chegg has grown, basically, has put together quarterly growth for 5-6 years. It's too early to tell if something, it's too early to tell what's going on. It looks like what's happened is much fewer people are enrolling in university. So university enrollment is down. The whole sector's under a lot of pressure. People using Chegg to cheat. So people put questions online on Chegg and then detailed answers. And often these would be for assignments this was kind of like an amazing tool because you could go on Chegg and find worked answers to difficult problems that you couldn't solve as a student. But Chegg cooperated with the university to help catch cheaters once, and then I think that the community turned off them. That's just one thing I would note that you won't get from the company materials, is the controversy over that. I'm not sure on Chegg, not sure it's a winner at the moment. I think we need to see what happens with enrollments settling down. But you know, that they have delivered for a very long period of time. So you're actually pretty unlucky to get it right before they do. Possibly if Solana follow ETH. Well, it's kind of my favorite one. Of those kind of layer ones, the ones that like are the base, think about layer ones, they're the ones like Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana. They're trying to use them as to transact for everything else. And then the layer twos are kind of like, they'll either use the chains just for certain parts of verification, or you know, they'll be developing new business models, they'll be using the chain as a tool. Solana is my personal favorite, but we don't invest in these in the fund, by the way. Things like Voyager Digital, Coinbase, equities, users, revenues, profits, audited accounts, that kind of thing is stuff we can definitely do in the fund. Benetech. I do not know Benetech. Shoot me an email and I'll take a look. Final Q&A. Okay. Allbirds. Yeah, to me it's growth. Customer love, but my first pair of Allbirds I thought were the best thing ever. My latest ones gave me blisters, so that's a little anecdote. But yeah, I'd measure Allbirds on its growth. They might have listed too late for... The people who made money probably got in a lot earlier, a lot cheaper, and this could be that moment where they're just like, right, let's realize as much value as possible. Thoughts on inflation? Look, we've kind of had we're up 13, 14% now. We had a pretty good few days. We're up 13, 14% for the calendar year. It hasn't been a great year, but it has been one of multiples compressing. The big one for us was probably the Chinese allocation. That was if we didn't do that, we'd probably be up a lot more. And if we got that right, it would have been like, you know, a 40, 50% year. That story is not quite over. But you can make money in these environments because in inflation, when rates are rising, things are generally booming. So the right companies with the right pricing power will do well. And of course, they'll do well in nominal dollars. So you could go back and say, actually, inflation was 4%. You know, the other thing is, if you've got a company growing at 10%, inflation's 4%, then you can go, okay, actually, your real growth is only 6%. You've got a company growing at like 80% and inflation is 4%. You can't say the same thing. There still is that genuine value creation. Iris Energy. Look, Iris Energy was pretty good. I think we saw it private, but we saw it pretty late in the game. I'm sure the round before us will make a lot of money and they're going to list. We'd invested pretty heavily in Mawson. Look, it seemed high quality as far as I could tell. There's a lot of them coming to market at the moment. Crypto mining is not as straightforward as it sounds. You know, there's issues like every few years, the total revenue of the crypto mining will halve. So you can't use the same valuation tools. And that's because Bitcoin is just designed that way. You can actually track it. So you know the Bitcoin price and you know the hash rate, which determines how much they make. You can track those things. So far, the hash rate has actually not gone up anywhere near what the Bitcoin price has done, partly because all the Chinese miners went off and partly because I guess the link is just not that tight. So at the moment, I suspect any mining company that has their act together will be making a ton of money. Also, everybody's going from proof of work to proof of stakes. The idea is it's bad for the environment, too much electricity. Even if you use green renewable sources, that green energy should be put somewhere else where it's more useful. But because of that, it is the most secure. So let's say the US government decided tomorrow that they wanted to dominate. Where would they get the mining computers to do it, the chips? You couldn't do it. Like, there's only so many that can be created in the world and they're all spoken for. So the worst thing about it, which is the energy issue, is also why it will always be the most secure. Commonwealth Bank accepting crypto trading. I'm interested to see what they do if they allow trading. Obviously, they have KYC on other clients, so it should be straightforward. I'm surprised it's Commonwealth Bank doing it first. Yeah, it'll be interesting. Got to remember, in Australia, it has a pretty intense regulatory environment for banks. Very kind of aggressive politicians, very aggressive legal systems. You can get people that are kind of mid-level executives, you know, on balance trying to do the right thing, who then get hauled up in front of commissions and grilled over sometimes valid, sometimes not valid reasons. Those things, there is an impact to that kind of stuff. And it does make people, I'm sure it has, I mean, I know it has slowed down the inner workings of these banks when it comes to proving new things and innovation. And often those often hauling the bankers up in court for things that they didn't know about or whatever it is, often that can backfire. So and often that kind of like line of thinking that banks are bad can backfire too. For example, the simplest thing is that generally very quickly prices out the poorest people. So the more regulations you put in on lending and lending laws and responsible lending laws, you make it easy for rich people with rich parents to get loans, or they can just, it's not a problem for them, almost impossible for a struggling young family. And the funny thing is like, I'm sure if those people that were doing, like, have that, like, banks are bad kind of mentality, they'd want to help the kind of poorer, like the less advantaged people. But often there's, like, often it goes the other way. So it's pretty bold from Commonwealth Bank, because if there is some kind of scandal, AML, KYC, all those executives are going to get raked through the coals. Good luck to them. Global gaming TAM and growth rate. Ooh, I'm not sure. I think there's a good question here about what happens when it reverses. Gaming has always had this thing where the amount of money spent on it relative to the time spent it was out of whack. That's now correcting. I reckon with these crypto games where you're playing for cryptocurrency, there's just so much more involved. Like, the stakes are higher, more exciting, more fun. My guess is it's going to dramatically expand the gaming TAM. And, you know, there's 500,000 players of Axie in the Philippines. That's 500,000 people like earning money. Apparently, like I don't know the exact number, but tens of thousands of them are going to be, you know, making more there than they could on the average wage in the Philippines. I think you're going to see a lot more of that. I think this cryptocurrency thing really balances things out. These are open networks accessible to anybody on the planet. People with lots of time and no money can find ways to convert that into cryptocurrency and then spend that in a way that, you've got to remember, like, in Australia and the West, our financial system is very secure. If anywhere in Africa, where there are a lot of people, or South America, or Southeast Asia, you know, in living memory, many of these peoples have had savings wiped, capital controls, you know, even parts of Europe, capital controls like Cyprus, you know, these are things that happen. The fact that you can like convert electricity into global currency or convert gaming time into globally transactable currency, pretty revolutionary and pretty exciting. So I'm going to keep writing some of these posts. We did one on art, music, gaming. I want to address the criminal side of things. Actually, there's an interesting, the main point on the criminal side of things, I predict that there's secret coins that are really good for criminals. So Bitcoin people got in trouble because every address, you can see every transaction. You can go on a Bitcoin scan or Etherscan, every single transaction you can see. And so if somebody got caught, and basically everybody in the Silk Road got, a lot of people in the Silk Road got caught, you could then see who had transacted with that wallet. And again, it's anonymous, it's pseudonymous, but if that person then had transacted with Coinbase or anywhere, anything else, you could then immediately identify who had been transacting. There are some cryptocurrencies that hide that kind of stuff that are secure. So Monero is the biggest one. And you'd think if it was being used for that, that Monero would be the best performer, but it hasn't. It's really surprising. It's dramatically underperformed. And then the ones like Solana and obviously Ethereum have taken more and more market share from Bitcoin as the whole thing has expanded. And so the criminal use case is much smaller than everybody thought. And that's like a numerical evidence-based reason to suggest that. Yeah, I'll do some more articles on that. Also, we have done a lot of work on the different crypto miners, the listed exchanges, like ways that you can play cryptocurrency in equity markets. And these are the fastest growing companies. And, you know, there's already a bit of a shift between the wealth of people that... It reminds me of real estate. So there's some people that just intrinsically don't buy real estate. There's some families that just never bought real estate. And there's some families that did systematically for 10, 20, 30 years. The ones that did just made so much more money. And I know there's been a huge boom, so this is exceptional. But, you know, even like conversations I was having with people 5 years ago or 10 years ago, like should we try and scrabble together some dollars and buy like a tiny apartment to live in or just pay rent? All the people that went on that side and bought the apartment have done exceptionally well. I feel like cryptocurrencies, and it's almost like a huge shift in the people that bought and people that didn't. I feel like cryptocurrency might be something similar, where the people that are positive about it just end up materially more wealthy than the people that kind of hate on it the whole way. And that's certainly true as of today. I think it'll be true going forward as well. I think that's it. I think that's all the questions. Is there anything else? Will you list Fraz's partners anytime soon? Maybe in a few years. We'll see. In that case, I will wrap things up. Wow, that's the longest one we've done. Thanks so much for signing in. I will post this on YouTube. If you have any more questions that you want me to address next time, shoot me an email and I will add them to the list. And really appreciate you taking the time to listen in. Enjoy the rest of your day.